Chapter 19. You can't still be brooding, Miles says, with far more judgment than Jaster thinks is entirely warranted. I'm not brooding, he protests, quiet, because the weight against his shoulder is steady, warm. John is asleep against his side, whole body turned towards Jaster, hair a soft dark tangle around his face. The fact that one of his hands is threaded through Jaster's is making it hard to turn the pages of his book, which is maybe part of why Jaster hasn't been reading it, but hardly a bad thing, hardly a complaint. Morose contemplation, Miles offers, and when Jaster levels a look at him, he raises his hands. Between Tor, Arla, and your fiancé almost disappearing, I don't think anyone would blame you. Jaster breathes out, sets his book aside at last. When he slides his arm around John's back, John doesn't stir, just keeps breathing quietly against his shoulder, and Jaster is grateful, in a way. I wasn't thinking about Tor, he admits, and meets Miles's gaze. Not entirely, at least. John, he reacts like Arla used to. Miles blinks, like he's been caught off guard, and glances down at John for a moment. Pauses there, thoughtful, and then says, no wonder she likes him more than I expected her to. Arla is, despite the front she puts up, highly empathic, sensitive to others' emotions, as Jaster knows children hurt by those around them often are. John is a Jedi, so the empathy is likely standard, and it had made Jaster miss the signs. Between John's reserve and the Jedi oddness, he'd just overlooked things. I would like it, he tells Miles, if you would remind me once in a while that I'm an idiot. Every day, if you want. Miles raises a brow at him, then settles on the other end of the bench with a sigh, stretching his legs out and rolling his neck. It looks like the base they found was deserted in a hurry, but we're chasing down the Firehand gang connection that John gave us. Good. Pull extra troops from the palace on Mandalore to cover the search teams. Jaster sees the protest Miles is about to make and shakes his head. Between security for the wedding and this, we need every spare body. The palace will survive. Tor wants to live there, so he won't destroy it entirely. You hope, Miles says, but he pulls his pad out, makes a note. I have several guests who told me they're going to arrive tomorrow, and I made arrangements to set aside a guest wing for them. Whatever security they bring can help reinforce things here. Only those we're sure will be loyal, Jaster says quietly, rubbing his thumb across John's scarred knuckles. There's a breath against his shoulder, a shift, and Jaster can't help but smile a little, watching John's lashes flutter. Has Arla been pried out of her armor? I caught her and Zarin sucking face against the door to her quarters, and the cook told me they ordered dinner in, Miles says dryly. Zarin will handle it. Jaster snorts, amused, but he's more than happy to leave that battle to their armorer. Zarin knows what she's doing. Good. Everything else settled? As much as it can be. Miles is silent for a moment, watching the clouds move over the garden, and then says, I never thought you'd be the first one to get married somehow. Nor did I, Jaster says dryly, but he can't help stealing another glance at John, arm tightening a little before he can stop himself. Married, and it's hardly the same thing as a love match, but the end result is the same, more or less. The day after tomorrow, he's going to be a married man, and he and John will have to figure out how to share a life. All the rocky bits so far have been mildly alarming as a portent to what's coming, but Jaster finds, to his surprise, that he isn't dreading it. Have you drafted your message to Chancellor Valorum? Miles asks. Or are you going to notify the Order first? Jaster pauses, startled, surprised that the question has taken him by surprise. The whole point of this marriage is for his people, to force the Republic to acknowledge him, give him the leeway of recognition to bargain and trade, and find supplies for war-torn Mandalorian space. But he's been too tangled up in John's existence, to even think of the letter all of this is meant to produce. "Oh," Miles says, deeply amused. "Too distracted by your honeymoon, then? Or was it the moping that was taking up all your time?" Jaster kicks him in the ankle. "It certainly was not. I've just been... distracted. Not from his people, not to the exclusion of all else, but the reason for the wedding has been overshadowed, in a way, by the fact of the wedding, by the fact of John. And Jaster never would have expected himself to fall prey to such a thing. I have an early draft of it," he says, not quite defensive. "Intended for the Senate, specifically. They keep records of diplomatic events, and I was going to alert them to the fact that they missed this one." Miles snorts. "The transmission was lost," he asks dryly. "It's a common excuse for a reason," Jaster counters, "particularly coming from Mandalorian space. There's so much distance to cover, you know. So terribly many things that could go wrong and lead to the Republic envoy missing my wedding, even though I made a point to invite them. Notified just a little too late to put a halt to things. Tragic." Miles makes another note. "We may at least get a nice gift out of it. The Republic doesn't skimp, even if they're cowards about picking sides." "They won't have a choice after this." Jaster can't help but look down at John again, sleeping peacefully against his collarbone. A pawn, Jaster thinks, and it aches somewhere deep in his chest. A pawn in Jaster's attempts to gain power, to stop the civil war, to end Tor's cruelty. Maybe someday Jaster will find the words to apologize for all of this, but he doesn't regret it. Whatever that says about him, it's likely not very good. "Mandalore?" Miles asks, and when Jaster glances up, Miles is watching him carefully. Second thoughts, because if you call the wedding off one day in advance, I absolutely will paint a bright red target on your ass and hunt you for sport. Half of the Journeyman Protectors tried that when I was exiled from Conquered Dawn, and none of them succeeded. Jaster drags his thumb over John's knuckles again, just looking at him. Looking at the faint curl at the ends of his hair, at the shadow of his lashes against his cheek, at the way his lips almost touch Jaster's skin, where John's weight tugs his shirt collar sideways. Every inch of his body where it's pressed against Jaster's is exquisitely tangible, and Jaster can feel him breathing, soft and steady. Such a simple thing, the rise and fall of his chest, but Jaster can't think of anything but some great tide, inexorable, beautiful. Plain, unremarkable, yet even so, Jaster can't drag his attention away, even for a moment. Miles kicks him hard in the ankle, and Jaster startles, jerks his head up. "Jaster," Miles says, and from his tone, it's not the first time. Jaster winces. "I think," he says, with all the dignity he can muster, "that I'm rather tired tonight. Would you repeat that?" "Are you tired, or is your fiancé attractive?" Miles asks dryly. There's no good way to answer that question, so Jaster doesn't try. Thankfully, Miles takes pity on him in this, at least. "Take him to bed, then. We can talk in the morning." He reaches out, aiming for John's shoulder, but Jaster catches his hand before it can make contact. "Let him sleep," he says quietly. "I'll carry him there." Miles looks at him for a long second, then smiles. "Of course, Mandalore," he says, and rises, tucking his pad under one arm. "Let me get the doors for you, at least." "Thank you, Miles." Carefully, Jaster shifts, settling John more securely against his shoulder, then reaching down to slide an arm beneath his knees. He picks him up, like that first meeting on the battlefield, but this time, John isn't flinching away from him, isn't about to bleed out in his arms. John turns his face towards Jaster instead, breathes out, slides a hand up to grip his shirt, and Jaster just stands there for a moment, supporting his weight, holding him, curled in against Jaster's chest, his loose hair falling over his face and his expression peaceful. It feels, Jaster thinks as he swallows, like holding something very vast in his arms, for all that John is lighter than he should be, lanky and muscular but underfed. Something to take care of now that he's here, now that they're going to be married. The day after tomorrow, Jaster is going to strap his Vambrace around John's arm, give it to him to wear for the rest of his life, and it's just for politics. It's wholly for the benefits it will bring. But some part of Jaster is still tense and ready and waiting, like the day can't possibly come too soon. Jaster, Miles asks, poised at the door back into the compound. Jaster doesn't startle, but it takes him a moment before he can find the will to lift his head, to shift his grip. He must be tired after all the trouble he and Django and Arla got into, he says, just a little rough in his throat, and carefully mounts the steps, turning a little to get past Miles. Miles's gaze slides over his face, assessing, looking for something, though Jaster isn't sure what. Even if the Jedi he found healed him, it's still a strain, probably, he says, like a Bacta tank. He pauses for a moment, falling into step as Jaster heads down the hallway, and then asks, "You have your Vambrace ready?" "Of course." Jaster resettles John slightly, trying fruitlessly not to pay attention to the scars he can see, the edge of a sharp collarbone, the strangely vulnerable hollow there. But it's so hard to look away, now that he knows John doesn't hate him, doesn't fear him. "It helps, the reminder that you're the present." What could Jaster possibly say to that? What exists in the entirety of the universe that could put into words how it feels to be John's present, a grounding force, a relief? "One of us should make sure John knows what will be required of him," he manages, even though the words want to stick in his throat. "During the ceremony." Miles snorts, getting the next door. "He already asked me," he says, and raises a brow at whatever expression must be on Jaster's face. "Brought me tea and wanted the rundown. It won't be a problem." John was asking about the wedding, preparing, accepting what was happening, likely while Jaster was avoiding him and any thought of his own part in forcing John into marriage. Jaster smiles, rueful, entirely and helplessly amused at himself, and strokes a thumb over the curve of John's shoulder. "Thank you for answering," he tells Miles. "I'm glad you have someone to share your blasted twig water with." "You're a Philistine," Miles counters, but he gets the next door too, nodding at the pair of guards stationed there, and then following Jaster across the small courtyard. Everything is ready for the trip back to Mandalore after the wedding, but there have been some whispers about threats in Kel'Dabi, and the security chief is worried about more bombings. "I'm assuming you don't have plans for a honeymoon just yet, but..." "Is there somewhere else we can go?" Jaster finishes for him, and contains a sigh. He's called Kel'Dabi his home for years now, and it's where the Mandalore is supposed to sit, but his presence there puts the population at risk. Tor targets all of Mandalore's cities heavily, trying to cow the most influential clans into supporting him, but he takes particular glee in aiming his attacks at those around Jaster specifically. Not just his aides and soldiers, but civilians, staff, outside traders who try to help. Kel'Dabi is full of targets, and Jaster would prefer to avoid returning until the true Mandalorians have made at least some headway against the Death Watch. "Ordo," Miles suggests after a moment. "We have Clan Ordo's support, and Tor likely won't suspect the move. Not many people visit Ordo anymore." "Because the clan is insufferable," Jaster says. Tellingly, Miles doesn't even attempt to argue. "Jarboon, perhaps. The governor is ostensibly neutral, but she's been leaning far more toward our side than Tor's, particularly after the last attack." Miles frowns, snapping his pad back open to check something. "I think my parents' old teacher is living there now, and she's close to the governor. I'll see what I can arrange and let you know." "Thank you, Miles." Jaster nods to the next set of guards, then keeps going down the corridor, shifting John slightly. There is a slight heavier breath, a shift, a breath against his throat that makes his skin prickle, but Jaster just tightens his grip faintly and keeps moving. "Offer her what we can spare from the relief supplies as well. They're still rebuilding, I believe." Yes, Mandalore. Miles gets the door to Jaster's quarters, then steps in, leaning against the frame as Jaster crosses the space and bends down, laying John out as gently as he can. When Jaster straightens, Miles is smiling again, a warm and faintly crooked thing. "Careful, Jaster," he says. "Someone's going to accuse you of making this something besides a political arrangement." Jaster glances back at John, the lanky, scarred body stretched out in his bed, and thinks of waking up with John in his arms, of the way John folds into his grip when Jaster embraces him, like it's something to be enjoyed, cherished. Lightly, he reaches out, skims his fingertips across John's cheek, and smiles a little to himself. "Would that be such a bad thing?" he asks, without glancing back at Miles. "To enjoy being married to an intriguing and kind and beautiful man." Miles chuckles, pushing up straight, and steps back. "Good night, Mandalore," he says tolerantly, and waves the door shut behind him as he vanishes back into the evening light. The beep of a comm pulls John out of his early morning meditation. Jaster is still asleep in the bed, hasn't stirred since John pulled himself out from under the warm blankets to run through his katas now that he's free of pain. It makes John move a little more quickly to answer than he otherwise might, and he unfolds himself, grabs the comm, and slips out the door to the garden, only briefly pausing to glance at the code before he accepts the transmission. "Master Dyeth," he says, sinking down on the steps again. "Master Antilles," Nico returns, and the narrow sweep of his gaze is assessing, though not hostile. "Your condition seems to have improved. No longer dying, I presume." "I'm fine," John says, not quite sure how else to answer. "Do you need help to rescue your partner?" "Partner," a voice from out of view of the projector says, bland. "Are you calling me your partner now, Dyeth? To virginal ears, heavens forbid." Nico looks rather like he's contemplating homicide. "A gross overstatement only for the sake of expediency," he retorts, and then says to John, "only from his own idiocy, yet again." All of John's memories of Nico are of someone who was kind, but very, very cold whenever Dark Woman addressed him, and this feels more like how he truly is, John thinks, hiding a smile. "Don't take amusement at my suffering," Nico tells him, aggrieved, and then pauses. He folds his hands into the sleeves of his robe, then says far more seriously, "John, you were asking about the governor of Concord Dawn. Are you on the planet at the moment?" John hesitates, but he can't see the trap in answering. "Yes, did you find something?" Nico glances sideways, out of frame, and a moment later another figure joins him, a tall human man about Nico's age, with dark hair and a neatly trimmed beard just starting to go gray. His expression is stern, assessing, but when Nico elbows him, it softens faintly, settles into an exasperation that's more fond than annoyed. "I've spent more years in Mandalorian space than Nico, so I took up your question, forgive me," he tells John, inclining his head. "A contact in Concord Dawn's government raised concerns to me about Aga Kast and her loyalties. There's been a fair amount of movement over the last 10 days as well, and I thought it concerning enough to alert you." The governor gave Jaster until just after the wedding to leave, John thinks, turning the warning over in his mind. A neutral stance, but something about it doesn't sit right. What Dooku felt, doubtless, but it settles heavy in John's chest, makes him wary. "Any direct ties to the Death Watch?" he asks quietly. The discovery of the Death Watch's Gargan base could have pushed Kast into more immediate action, motivated her to move against Jaster. Nico trades glances with Dooku, then says, "Not that we were able to find, but the Death Watch has plenty of friends who prefer not to make their allegiances known." The lack of solid evidence makes it hard to do anything, especially when Jaster is still technically exiled from the planet. John inclines his head, worrying at the thought, and he could likely find something, given enough time to dig. But the wedding is tomorrow, so there is no time, and all of John's bad feelings are centered around the wedding itself. "Thank you for the warning," he says quietly. "I appreciate you taking on the matter, Master Dooku." Certainly, Dooku says, precise. I would advise you to leave Concord Dawn, at least for the near future. The Death Watch has been all too active recently. I can't leave until the day after tomorrow at the earliest, John says, but I'll be careful. He hesitates, weighing his next question, then asks, Master Dyeth, have you heard anything about Master Venari or Master Fae? Noel? Nico's brows rise. Not in the last few weeks. Were you hoping to reach her? I have her comm code, though I can't help you contact Fae. She seems to have the same aversion to carrying a comm that she does to carrying a lightsaber. John hides his amusement, shakes his head. Master Venari was captured by the Death Watch, he says, on one of Gargan II's moons. Master Fae and I rescued her. I just wanted to be sure they'd both made it out all right. I'll calm Noel directly and find out, Nico says, frowning. A bold move by the Death Watch to actually capture a Jedi. For blackmail, do you think? The Order might negotiate if they felt there was a cause, Dooku says, though he hardly looks happier. There is... JT, Arla calls, on the edge of angry, and John jerks, almost dropping the comm as he wrenches to his feet. Arla is stalking across the grass, her armor bright and polished and menacing in the dawn light, and he quickly ends the comm transmission before she can reach him. She doesn't pause, but thumps up the steps and demands, What the hell is my idiot brother up to? John blinks, faintly bemused. Django, he asks, and at the sound of inarticulate rage Arla makes, he quickly raises his hands. I haven't even seen him. So what? Arla demands. You know things without seeing them, right? So, know why the hell he's been avoiding me all morning, and why he's been taking secret comms that he doesn't want anyone to hear? Arla, my love, leave John out of your spats with Django, Jaster says, opening the glass door to give her a level, speaking look. Or ask Silas. He usually knows what Django is doing. Arla's attention sharpens, knife-like. Silas, she repeats, and turns on her heel without so much as another word. Her jetpack fires, and she lifts off, arrowing for the far side of the compound like a streak of shadowed lightning. John watches her go, then glances back at Jaster. You're sacrificing Silas to her, he asks. Jaster chuckles. Silas is currently with Miles, he says, so technically I'm sacrificing Miles to her. It'll be fine, though. Arla is just overprotective of Django. Understandable, given what John knows happened to her. He nods, then slips his comm away, climbing the few steps up to the door, and Jaster immediately holds out his hands. It should be strange, jarring, to be welcomed like that, invited to touch, but when John slides his hands into Jaster's, lets himself be pulled close, it just feels warm. As he settles against Jaster's bulk, his warmth, there's a quiet sound of amusement, a hand stroking over his hair. Good morning, John, Jaster says, low, beside his ear, and John can't quite contain the shiver it rouses. He makes a sound of agreement, sliding his fingers over the muscle of Jaster's back, the line of his spine. Jaster is warm, and he smells of metal and sweat and just a little like old paper, sweet in John's nose. When he wraps his arms tight around John, it's good. It's very good. It is, John says, a little rough. A good morning. And despite all the edges of wariness about what's to come, that's entirely the truth. John doesn't hurt, and he's warm, well-rested, has Jaster's arms tight around him. Jaster's hugs are all-encompassing, surrounding, and John thinks he could stay in them for the rest of his days and be happy with that. It is, Jaster agrees, amused, and his fingertips catch John's jaw, tip his head up. John opens his eyes, looks at Jaster across the bare inch separating them, and just can't stop looking. Jaster's brown eyes are soft, the set of his mouth is a temptation. Stubble catches on John's fingertips when he dares to brush the backs of his fingers over Jaster's cheeks, and the distance makes him want to shiver, want to close the distance. Last time, Jaster pulled away, pushed John away, but this feels different. This feels like space left open between them, ready to be crossed. I want to kiss you, John manages, and Jaster closes his eyes, lips parting on a breath. "How fortunate, then, that I very desperately want you to kiss me too," he says, and John can't help but smile, even with his heart beating in his throat. He leans in, ducking his head slightly, and Jaster's fingertips drag through his hair, make his nerves light up with a wash of awareness. Jaster is so close, so solid, so real. And John has never been this close to anyone before, never even wanted to be. But Jaster is different. He defies everything John thought he knew about himself in all the best ways. John kisses him, and this time it isn't sudden, isn't clumsy, isn't the precursor to a desperate withdrawal. Slow, sweet, careful, Jaster kisses him back. No surprise in him, just heat. There are hands on John's hips, holding him close, and Jaster's lips are a brand, his touch a magnet. The slant of his mouth steals every last bit of John's breath, and he wraps his arms around Jaster's neck, sinks against him, and Jaster holds him up, holds him close, holds him tight. It's warm in the morning brilliance, and even if there are storm clouds gathering, for right now, John doesn't want anything more than a long kiss in the sunlight. End of chapter 19.